Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. Quickly checking Valley traffic. Couple of accidents, 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway at 24th Street. Also on the 101 westbound at 19th Avenue. Cloudy skies for the rest of the day. 30% chance for some rain this afternoon. Look for a high of 99. Partly cloudy and a 40% chance of rain tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-80s. Drying out for the weekend. Sunny skies. High of 104 tomorrow. 107 on Sunday. It's 92 degrees right now. Officials with the Arizona Department of Transportation are gearing up for the heavy traffic expected this holiday weekend. KJZZ's Carrie Young reports.
ADOT says they've identified three travel corridors this 4th of July weekend. I-17 between North Phoenix and Flagstaff, I-10 between Phoenix and Tucson, and State Route 87 between Mesa and Payson. Doug Pacey is an ADOT spokesman. He says officials have strategically placed equipment along these routes.
Things like loaders, utility trucks, attenuators. That way, in the event of a crash, we can have a faster response time and minimize travel delays for the traveling public.
ADOT reported 11 fatal crashes last 4th of July weekend, eight of which involved drivers who had been drinking. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Police officers, firefighters, business owners, and residents packed Phoenix City Council chambers earlier today for a critical vote. The council had to either approve a property tax hike or start cutting a budget they just passed 2 months ago. KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Estes has been covering the process for months and was there for the vote, which ultimately surprised some people. Why is that?
Well, no one knew how it would turn out until the actual roll call. One council member that was considered an unknown vote came out against the property tax increase. Another member some thought would probably vote in favor also spoke out against it. And just moments before the roll call, it seemed the no camp was gaining momentum. Councilman Sal DeCicio and Jim Waring, the most vocal fiscal conservatives there, suggested the group meet during July rather than take their summer break and find places to cut the budget. The mayor then asked City Manager Ed Zuercher, well, what would happen if the vote failed? Here's his response.
Well, never in the history of the city of Phoenix that I'm aware of has the council not adopted a property tax levy. So we would be in absolutely uncharted territory.
In the end, the property tax increase passed by a 5-4 vote. So what's this going to cost homeowners and how will the money be spent?
The city manager says the average homeowner will pay about $51 more this fiscal year. Now, that's based on a home's full cash value of $191,000. How they will spend that extra $37 million that will be generated was the whole reason behind the debate. The city manager said the tax increase would be used to pay debt on bond projects, while opponents pointed out the city had a $60 million surplus, and this budget includes $50 million in new spending for things like body cameras for police officers. $20 million will also go to cover concessions that employee union groups made during the recession.
And the employee unions, including police and fire, have been really vocal in supporting the budget and the tax increase. What about other groups? What did you hear today?
Well, there was a mix of people speaking in favor and against. What was most interesting was how different the public comments were today versus the 15 meetings the city held during the entire budget process. The people who attended those meetings were overwhelmingly in support of the property tax increase. That point has been brought up several times by the city manager and others. It was mentioned again today, with one woman even scolding council members for not listening to what the majority of people want. Councilman Jim Waring called that ridiculous and said the supporters in those 15 meetings totaled just over 200 people.
Do you know what percentage those 203 people represent of Phoenix's 1.5 million population? 0.000135.
Waring said that he speaks for the 200,000 people in his district. While he was unable to get the majority of council members to side with him, it was a closer vote than many expected.
And with that vote, Phoenix property owners will see the increase on their tax bills from the county this fall. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes, thanks.
You're welcome.
Arizona's Native American Indian tribes are moving to diversify their economies, and instead of relying on casino revenue, they're starting to use that money on other kinds of projects. The Phoenix Business Journal writes about this in today's edition. Senior writer Mike Sonnix joins me. So, Mike, is it fair to say that tribes, especially those around the valley here, are really trying to do things differently economically?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're well beyond gaming and casinos. casinos now, especially Salt River and Gila River. Corporate headquarters on the Salt River, they got the aquarium they're building, they got the D-backs and Rockies. If you look down at the Gila River, they got the outlet malls, they got a five-star restaurant.
Rawhide is down there.
Rawhide's down there, they got the racetrack. And so the casino money has kind of allowed them to diversify and be entrepreneurial and kind of not be so reliant on the federal government as they have in the past, which has just not been a good deal for them. So they have a lot more options. And if you look at that that stretch of the 101 where the Salt River land is, I don't know if you have a stretch of land like that kind of undeveloped throughout the country in a major U.S. city. That's just prime land.
Is reservation land in some ways maybe more appealing to businesses as well because there are fewer regulations and maybe a little bit less red tape to get stuff done?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. That's true. And if you look at what the Coyotes may be doing, they're looking at putting an arena out there. They don't have to go through all the politics that they would go through in, say, Phoenix or another location. But in the past, you know, the tribe owns the land. So, you know, the private entities, developers have to lease it. That turns off some people. In the past, the tribes have been seen as moving slower. And so that's turned off some developers, especially in a market like Phoenix where it's boom and bust and there's bubbles and things are going fast. There's a lot of speculation. But I think some of the developers that are starting to learn that, hey, it might take a little bit longer. There might take some patience and the deal may be different. But the rewards are there. The tribes seem to be, you know, good partners with a lot of private enterprises now. I think the tribes are more comfortable dealing with outside businesses.
How do tribal officials evaluate potential projects that they might want to be involved in?
They get tons of proposals, especially the tribes that are in the Phoenix area, the tribes that have a tourism aspect up by the Grand Canyon. They get presented things all the time from developers, from tourism groups, from those types of things. And, you know, they do try to look a little skeptically upon them to start. One of the folks that we talk to in our package of stories, you know, so they're kind of start off with a no because they get so many proposals. And, you know, a lot of times there are plenty of companies here and in California and in Nevada that are used to dealing with Native American communities, but some aren't. And so they don't know the rules of the road. And so they do look skeptically and they do have different motivations than private enterprises or businesses. They're beholden to their community, to their members, to the tribe versus shareholders, profit margins, or the owners of the company.
Is this kind of portfolio diversification really unique to these urban tribes, or as you mentioned, some of the ones up near the Grand Canyon where there are large groups of people that travel, as opposed to some of the more remote tribes in Arizona?
Yeah, there's definitely haves and have-nots, just like a big market in a small town. The ones up by the Grand Canyon, the ones in northern Arizona, that can kind of leverage tourists either from here or from Las Vegas, you know, are really looking at that. And if you talk to those Native American communities, they're tied in more with people from Las Vegas because that's a big group of the tourists that come into the Grand Canyon and other places. So they're linked there. You know, down here, there's plenty of developers. There's plenty of entertainment options. Things that you would see in Tempe and Scottsdale are the things that could land on the Gila River or Salt River lands. The tribes that are remote, they still have a challenge, just like a remote city, a remote little town in Arizona or New Mexico would face.
How do these different kinds of projects and the revenue that they bring in impact the members of each individual community?
The tribe thinks about that when these projects come in. What's going to be the best, you know, for all of our members and stuff? And I think some businesses, outside businesses, you know, don't realize that sometimes. And some of it is in jobs. They do require a lot of times, you know, to try to hire as many tribal members or Native Americans. So they want to lift that up because, you know, we see a lot of these projects, but there's still challenges on a lot of Native American reservations, you know, with health care, with income levels. And so the tribes are always kind of sensitive to that as they kind of move forward with projects.
Mike Sonics is a senior writer for the Phoenix Business Journal. Mike, thanks.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Starting today, the Phoenix Police Department will test all sex crime evidence collection kits, commonly known as rape kits, that come into the agency. The department's crime lab will also test the approximately 1,700 untested kits it has. Assistant Police Chief Mary Roberts says this new policy will help police across the valley.
Law enforcement agencies, we do not communicate. We are unable to compare. We do not have the same record management system. So maybe he's listed as a suspect in the Phoenix case. Maybe that exact same guy is listed as a person of interest in another case or an investigative lead in another jurisdiction's case.
Robert says it'll cost about $1,000 to test each kit and that it takes a lot of work after that test is done to investigate the case. Advocates are applauding the Phoenix police for this change. Tasha Maniker is one of them. She's the director of sexual violence response initiatives at the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual and Domestic Violence. And Tasha, to you, what is the significance of this new procedure?
Well, I think the benefit of testing all of the kits is that we increase the likelihood that we can identify unknown offenders as well as serial offenders. We know that in the majority of sexual assault cases, the perpetrator is known to the victim, but it's still important to test these kits because that DNA, once it's entered into CODIS, it might reveal that this offender has a pattern of doing this behavior over time and in different jurisdictions.
Do you think that police departments across the valley have missed out on catching perpetrators because some of these kits have not been tested?
I don't know if that's the case. I think that in testing these kits, we're just going to increase the likelihood that we'll identify these patterns and these serial offenders.
Did you expect that this would happen? I mean, did you think that the department would ultimately decide to go ahead and do this?
I'm not surprised that they would move forward in this direction. I think in my experience in working with the Phoenix Police Department, they do have a victim-centered approach, and they are thinking about what's best for not only victims but the community.
This issue has obviously gotten a little more attention recently. Governor Ducey has talked about it. Now the Phoenix Police Department has made this change. Do you get the sense that this issue of rape kits and untested kits is starting to gain momentum to try to get rid of some of the backlogs?
Absolutely. I think that's true not only in Arizona, but across the nation.
Were there other agencies that you know of that had similar situations where they had backlogs like Phoenix does and like Arizona does?
Yes, I'm aware of other jurisdictions that have had this backlog. I know Houston and Detroit, New York, Los Angeles, New Orleans. I think many places have experienced this issue.
And they're starting to do what Phoenix is doing and try to go through that backlog and try to get themselves up to date?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that here in Arizona, we can learn from efforts that have been done in other places like Houston and Detroit that brought in research teams and took an evidence-based approach to understanding why kits weren't submitted and how we can prevent that from happening in the future.
Tasha Maniker is Director of Sexual Violence Response Initiatives at the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual and Domestic Violence.
Census data show Goodyear is the 14th fastest growing city in the country. But as Matthew Casey reports from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, some residents worry that investments in public safety aren't keeping up with development.
Rick Tooker woke up at 3 a.m. Easter morning to the sound of someone pounding on his front door. Tooker lives in a quiet area called Estrella Mountain Ranch, so he was surprised to see his neighbor's house on fire.
It was like almost like a jet engine was going off in there. The flames were actually just bellowing out of the garage.
Tooker grabbed his phone and called 911. He figured it wouldn't take long since the closest fire station is about 2 miles away.
While we were waiting for, it just seemed like ever, for the fire department, we keep wondering, they were asking me, did you call? I go, yeah, I called.
By the time crews arrived, they couldn't keep the blaze from gutting the home and killing the family dog. Some Southwest Valley residents say the incident is an example of what could happen if development continues to outpace the number of fire stations. With Goodyear on track to issue about 1,000 single-family home permits for the second year in a row, locals worry about how long the wait might be if they call 911. Cars whip past the intersection of Willis and Rainbow Valley Roads near Estrella Mountain Ranch. Goodyear planned to open Fire Station 186 here in 2009. But when the Great Recession hit, the city was forced to shelve the project. Stephen Gilman is president of the Goodyear Firefighters Union. We took a drive to see the distance between fire stations and new housing developments in the Estrella Mountain foothills.
The last fire station to be built was 2008 when our population was 60,000. Now we're all the way up to anywhere from 75 to 79,000, which is an increase of 25% in our population. And we still haven't expanded or grown public safety at the same rate as we have development.
Goodyear has set aside land for three fire stations, but it doesn't have money budgeted to build a new one until fiscal year 2022. There are a half dozen stations already. However, firefighters were reassigned after one closed in March when lead was found in water inside the building. Gilman says he thinks the recession, combined with scattered developments, have allowed Goodyear's growth to outpace resources.
The solution would be at some point, the city is just going to have to bite the bullet and figure out a way to fund public safety.
At City Hall, officials say that it is a priority. But rather than set aside roughly $7 million from this year's budget to build and staff another station near Estrella Mountain, Goodyear will spend about $60,000 for a citywide study on where new ones are needed. Communications manager Shireen Zaya says it should be done this fall.
Based on that study, it will be presented to council, and at that time, council will have the opportunity to make decisions as they relate to fire stations.
Goodyear will invest in its fire department during this fiscal year. It's buying three new trucks, replacing old equipment, and renovating the station that was closed. Police are also getting new gear like body cameras. Zaya says a citizen satisfaction survey played a big part in the council choosing to fund parks and recreation. About two-thirds of participants said they wanted parks expanded.
So because of that survey, some priorities were shifted in the capital improvement plan, and that included moving up the design and construction of a community park and of a recreation center, and I believe also aquatics.
Back at Estrella Mountain, resident Jennifer Barber thinks that's the wrong move. She's friends with the family whose house burned on Easter Sunday.
We want fire service before swing sets.
The city council recently considered amending a plan for up to 1,250 new homes. Construction could start as early as next year. Barber asked the council if they'll be able to provide, quote, adequate fire service.
They voted for the community, so apparently they think that they can do this. But they have a fire chief who is saying, hey, wait a minute, we're not meeting response times.
With only 11% of Goodyear's 190 square miles built out, Barber hopes city leaders will choose to invest in more fire stations before the sprawl gets too big to catch up. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Goodyear.
A new law passed during this year's legislative session requires the state and its cities and towns to provide first responders access to licensed counseling services under certain circumstances. Those include if they've been subjected to the use of deadly force, witnessed the death of a colleague, or responded to a dangerous crime against a child. Arizona joins the list of states passing these kinds of laws. With me to talk about that is Nancy Bowl Penrod, director of Counseling Team International, which provides services to first responders and public safety personnel around the country. And Nancy, are states really starting to look at this issue?
Yes. Actually, I think Arizona is ahead of the eight ball, and that since they have passed theirs, that more states will follow, because it is very important to have that available to first responders.
When did this start happening? I mean, when did it become okay for first responders to talk to somebody about what they go through?
Mark, I think about 20 years ago, actually. The trend at first was, you know, to have them talk after an officer-involved shooting, or after paramedics or fire service personnel went to a traffic accident that involved children. And there was some pushback. Naturally, 30 years ago, they believed that they could handle it themselves. And then around the middle of the 1980s, late, early 1990s, departments started recognizing how important it was. And then in the last 20 years, it has increased. But I can tell you, in the last 5 years, it has really taken off. And wellness for first responders is at the forefront of most every conference I attend, every conference that my chiefs attend. The idea of wellness for first responders is huge.
Do you find that first responders are amenable to talking to somebody about what they go through?
Absolutely. However, it depends on the upper echelon and if they promote it. If they say, look, I go and talk to someone if I need to. If they have their first-line supervisors promote it. And I think the more it's promoted by them, the more it's used. But I can tell you, most everyone that I know that works with first responders, they are getting busier and busier and busier.
Over the time that these services have become more available and more used, what kind of impact have you seen that have on fire departments, police agencies, other law enforcement and first responder agencies?
The first impact is less workers' comp claims. So if you want to look at it economically, it impacts departments economically in a very positive way. They don't retire as early. They don't file workers' comp claims, and they're off work, and now a department has to backfill their position. So the economics is huge. The other part of it is, on the human side, that they want to stay working. They appreciate the help from their department. They really feel grateful that their chiefs of police, their sheriffs, their fire chiefs care about them. And the more that they feel, you know, embraced and cared about, the more they want to stay at that department. So you don't get the transferring from one department to another as much, which costs also money to departments. I also believe that it impacts their families. And so the more the department takes care of them, the better family members they are, and the better spouses and husbands and better partners and fathers and mothers. So it's a positive impact all the way around.
Nancy Ball-Penrod is Director of Counseling Team International. Nancy, thank you.
You're welcome.
This week, we've been hearing stories about the people who are there for us after we've taken our last breath. It's part of the KJZZ series, The Business of Dying. Today, we shift gears slightly to talk about how death can sometimes mean new life.
Hi, my name is Winston Hewitt. I'm a transplant surgeon. I do liver, kidney, and pancreas transplantation. I wish I could say that my days were predictable, but transplantation is a specialty that's unpredictable by its very nature, and you never really know when a donor is going to become available. Usually, I go out to get the donor organ myself. So you're talking flying to wherever, California, Utah, New Mexico. We put in preservation solutions and keep it on ice to sort of slow the metabolic rate and maximize that length of time we have before they develop significant complications. And so it's timed such that when I get back with the organ, the recipient procedure is ready to start. But scrubbing in that few minutes of just standing there and washing your hands and preparing for the essential battle that is to come is kind of the calm of the entire process. Sometimes you want to be very careful and very slow and very methodical. Sometimes you want to get that liver out as quickly as possible because it's providing the source for their illness and acute liver failure. Ultimately, to see the kids grow up and live normal lives, as normal as they can, and do everything that they were supposed to do before they were on the pathway to possible disaster is very gratifying.
I don't really remember much of it because I was really sick, but I remember just being like top of the list for needing a new liver.
I think waiting for that liver, the days just weren't going by quick enough. Hi, I'm Christine.
Hi, my name is Maya and I'm from Buckeye.
Dr. Hewitt has been an incredible person for us.
Well, I was kind of scared. I was scared because I didn't know what was going to happen.
And I remember the day that we did get a liver when Dr. Hewitt walked in her room and said, Maya, we have a new part for you. And now is the time. We've written several letters to the donor's family, and I have actually four different copies that I plan on accumulating into one. And Maya is going to write a letter by the end of summer.
I don't really know how to word it, but I know I'm definitely going to say, like, thank you.
Just to find the right words to thank somebody for such an amazing gift is very difficult. Just to be able to show our gratitude and thank this wonderful family for giving us a second chance and for allowing Maya to be in our lives is incredible.
The only thing that just constantly pervades my thoughts and I think about before I go to sleep is about how amazing these donor families are, you know, for the deceased donor families, where at the time of their greatest loss, they can be selfless enough to offer the organs of their loved one to someone else so that someone else may enjoy long-term survival and contribute and do all the things that they were hoping of their lost loved one. That never ceases to impact me.
That surgeon Winston Hewitt and liver transplant recipient Maya Thompson with her mother Christine. You can find the rest of the series, The Business of Dying, at KJZZ.org.
A flashing light in the skies over the valley in the early morning on June 2nd has led to an exciting discovery. Researchers have found pieces of a small asteroid, and a team of meteorite hunters recently located 15 meteorites on tribal lands after getting permission to search. ASU Center for Meteorite Studies curator Lawrence Garvey was part of that team. Lawrence, is this something you ever imagined happening here?
I mean, every day we're waiting for something exciting to happen. That's part of science. You know, we have the daily science that we do. We go to the lab, we make some discoveries, we write our papers, we get our research grants. But we're always hoping for that every once in a while, something really exciting to happen. And that's really what happened here. This was unexpected. We weren't expecting this. This wasn't planned. Something just happened. You know, we saw this event on 2nd of June, and we were hoping, you know, we were hoping that there were rocks on the ground. And then comes the big excitement. Well, if there are rocks on the ground, what are they? What types of meteorites are on the ground? And so we had to wait. I mean, it was almost like a Christmas present that you couldn't open until Christmas, because we thought we had this tantalizing information that there were rocks on the ground. This was the Doppler radar that said, go and look here. But it was on land we couldn't access. So we had to wait for several weeks until access was granted, and which was we were very fortunate with. And then we went out there and started looking. And to our absolute amazement, we found stones on the ground.
I hate to ask one of those journalism questions of how did it feel, but how did it feel when you first discovered these things?
Well, it's exciting. I mean, it's difficult to express how exciting. People have to come and meet me, and I'll tell them how exciting. But, you know, I've never found a meteorite from a fall before. I study meteorites. I go into this fantastic meteorite vault at Arizona State University, the Center for Meteorite Studies, where I'm surrounded by meteorites from all over the world. But this was the first time I was actually able to go out. You know, I wasn't up at 3:55 in the morning, so I didn't see the event, but I saw the videos of it. So this was the first time I was able to go out and actually find something from a recent fall. So it was, and it still is a very exciting time.
What are certain questions you're going to go into it thinking, all right, these are the questions I need to ask myself when I'm looking at this, because you have so much background in meteorite studies.
The first question is, what type of meteorite is this? This is just like the basic fundamental question, what type is it? People have seen photographs of this already, and we know it's not an iron meteorite. We know it's stony. Mm. And so what is that telling us? You know, and that's really the questions that we're going to try to address over the next few weeks when we start to analyze this. So first thing I have to do is take a small piece, cut it. It sounds terrible that we actually have to cut a piece of meteorite to see what's inside it, but we have to cut it, put it in a microscope, and do the actual day-to-day science that we do on this thing.
What do you cut it with, and how small do you make it?
Oh, we cut it with a diamond saw. It's a rock, and we have to make a thin slice of it to put it into a microscope. And it's really using that microscope that allows us to determine what type of meteorite it is, what is its chemistry, what are its characteristics, how does it fit into the other meteorites, into the classification scheme that we have for the other meteorites. It's just sort of that general broad, these first order questions that we have to ask. And then once we get that initial information, we can start to answer the bigger questions. Is it an interesting meteorite? Mm-hmm. Is it an important? Is it something new? And I can't answer those questions yet because we haven't studied it.
For those of us who don't know much, it does feel like it would be. Is this the kind of thing that, as people might think, boy, science is hard, science is difficult to understand, this could be something that gets more people interested in it?
Absolutely. I mean, I sort of only half jokingly say that when we have public events at ASU where the public, the young kids come in, the two most exciting things for young kids is liquid nitrogen and meteorites. Oh, come on, they're the two most alien things that they will encounter in day-to-day life. So, you know, liquid nitrogen just doesn't make sense from most point of view. It's boiling at room temperature, and you can freeze things in it and break things in it. And meteorites are something alien.
So when you do hold it in your hand, does it become something for you that is simply a small part of a greater puzzle? Or is it something, at least for a moment, you can be as excited as the rest of us are?
I'm always excited, but let me just say, when I do hold it in my hand, I wear gloves. Well, you have to remember, just think of this thing that fell a few weeks ago. It was in pristine, deep space, high vacuum, no contamination whatsoever. So that's why there was a real sense to get out there as fast as possible and collect this thing. And then so we do collect them, we immediately put it in a plastic bag. And here's what's also interesting. We know almost certainly that there's much larger ones out there. And so we're going next week.
ASU Center for Meteorite Studies curator Lawrence Garvey. He was part of that team that located meteorites in the valley last month. We generally know what a disruption is. It's something, often a disturbance, that interrupts an activity or process. And that concept is going strong in the world of business, especially as innovation is happening more quickly and technology undergoes dramatic changes. To put business disruptors into context, I'm joined by Sydney Peck, CEO of Smart Brain Aging and an entrepreneurship instructor at ASU. Sydney, let's define those terms. Who or what is a business disruptor?
Disruption related to entrepreneurship is a new product, service, or a new business model that changes the way a market or a group of people behave. So it's when an entrepreneur takes a look at a customer need that exists, and instead of saying, I'll create a better version of what already exists, they take it in a completely different direction. So as an example, if we think about some of the most famous disruptors like Netflix, Netflix looked at a market need, and the need was, I would like to be entertained from the comfort of my own home. And they could have designed a fancier video store. Instead, they used technology that exists to say, how can we get this entertainment to people in a completely different way and absolutely change the way they operate?
So if a leader of a business wants to be a disruptor, that person has to be bold and has to be innovative. Does that person have to be also willing to fail and be smacked down a few times before breaking through?
Yeah, I think a lot of failure happens before disruption because you have to try things that people don't understand and don't accept. Probably if we had, or I'm sure we do, recordings of what people reacted to when we first said we would download videos from the cloud or that you would get in a stranger's car to get a ride somewhere through an app. People, of course, and probably still do say, that's crazy. I would never do that. A risk of failure is huge.
Sydney, I'm picturing that sort of satirical aspect where you have a bunch of men, usually white, they've all got their glasses on, they've got cigars in their mouth, and they're kind of, you know, laughing because they've got this sort of inner circle. I know that's not in and of itself reality, but is that sort of the reason why we need disruptors in order to make business and make society advance?
We all have a tendency of allowing our brains to stay with the familiar, and it's harder to try something new. It's harder to think in a different way. And business is hard. And so when you've set up something that works, it's much easier to incrementally improve. How do I make it cheaper, faster, better, easier access to my customers? Instead of saying, how do I completely erase everything that I know and think about it in a new way? So sometimes what we see is people who go from industry to industry, and because they aren't entrenched in the way that industry is supposed to work, they think about it from a different lens. There's a great book by Steven Johnson called Where Good Ideas Come From, and it talks about the concept that the more we know about so many other things that seem unrelated to our own business, the more likely we are to be innovative and have good ideas because we're looking at it from a different lens.
Well, does a disruptor allow for incremental progress, or simply by virtue of its definition, does a disruptor have to really sort of turn something over dramatically?
Yeah, so in my mind, the definition, those are two separate definitions. It's incremental innovation or disruptive innovation. So there's usually a lead disruptor, and a single company isn't going to own an entire market. So what they do is they take the risk, they get the initial education into the marketplace, and then a lot of other businesses can follow and either be supplemental products or services or can create the same product and service following their lead. So a disruptor really does open up the path for new innovators who aren't disruptors themselves, which is this long tail effect of how beneficial someone who takes this risk can be.
I wanted to ask if there are certain industries you've been watching really closely that either seem like they've been hit by disruptors more recently or that you're really watching closely to say, hey, that's sort of the next industry or the next industry or two where a disruptor could potentially be needed.
Sure. So the one that's very topical for us as a state and, you know, just in general for the last couple of years is the shared economy. Now we're in the phase where there's a lot of incremental add-ons to that. You know, from a hopeful standpoint, I absolutely wish for disruption in healthcare and education. I think disruption in education has been bubbling up for a long time with organizations like Teach for America that kind of set that going. But that's, you know, it's a very significant industry. And the more people involved and the more regulation, it's harder to disrupt. But I have high hopes that those two spaces will be disrupted very soon.
Sydney Peck is an entrepreneurship instructor at ASU and the CEO of Smart Brain Aging. We've been talking entrepreneurial and business disruptors.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. Exactly a week ago, the world was waking up to the shock that the UK had voted unmistakably to sever its ties with the European Union. Today, a week later, politics in London shows no signs of recovery.
The loser on the Brexit referendum, Prime Minister David Cameron, wasn't anticipating resigning when he started his Remain campaign. Boris Johnson, the former mayor of London, after being the champion of leaving the EU, apparently never really lined up supporters in case of a victory.
And yesterday, he pulled out of the running to lead the Conservative Party.
Having consulted colleagues and in view of the circumstances in Parliament, I have concluded that person cannot be me.
Another shocker revealing that the once rising star Johnson's best talent seems to have been alienating people. Now the attention turns to Justice Minister Michael Gove and Home Secretary Theresa May. And meanwhile, as the UK staggers about looking for a future, the EU is vigorously trying to publicly assert its relevance and power, even without the UK as a member. David O'Sullivan is the ambassador for the EU to the United States. He's one of those so-called faceless bureaucrats who were so demonized by the Leave campaign. He argues the anger toward the EU is fundamentally misplaced.
Firstly, I think that the criticisms of the way the EU functions, I get and I understand. But people, I think, forget too quickly that the European Union is essentially governed by our member states. The bureaucracy in Brussels, which, by the way, is not much bigger than the size of the city council in Birmingham or of a medium-sized German city, exists to implement the wishes of our people. So, respectfully, I don't think that Europe is run by a technocracy or a bureaucracy. It is run by democratically elected representatives of the people.
You know, I'm in America. You know, I don't need convincing, but you can't blame this on Cameron not explaining it well enough to the people. I mean, could you survive a referendum in every one of the EU member countries if it was held next month?
Well, firstly, not all our countries believe that referenda are the best way to settle political issues. To your point about the UK referendum campaign, respectfully, I don't wish to personalize this to Mr. Cameron, but it is not easy if you have been criticizing Europe frequently and loudly down through the years, suddenly in the course of a 6 weeks referendum campaign to explain to people that actually Europe is very good for you. These are complex issues. We're living through difficult times. There's a general sense of malaise in the European population, as there is here, that somehow our systems are not delivering for ordinary people in the way they once did. We should not run away from that discussion. But honestly, to start blaming the European Union as the source of all these problems, in my view, is to mistake the nature of the problem and, more importantly, to turn to solutions which will actually make things worse. I don't think the United Kingdom is going to be a better place as a result of leaving the European Union. And I fear this is what will be demonstrated in the next few years if this turns out to be the case.
Boy, if it's not demonstrated, then you really have an issue of not negativity, but just relevance, which is perhaps even worse.
Well, I mean, I to be clear, I don't wish the British people ill, but I do believe that economic performance is stronger for countries who have joined the European Union than for those who have not. If you look at Poland and how it has developed since the collapse of communism, compared, say, to Ukraine, which did not join the European Union, you can see a huge difference of trajectory. I think we don't necessarily do a good job of explaining that. And this is perhaps a moment of truth where we have to have an honest assessment. Do we really believe that this European Union delivers more benefits to our citizens than disadvantages? And I think we have to be willing to take on that debate. And frankly, I think if we do, we actually have a very good narrative.
All right, let me pretend to be a diplomat in the United States now and think about the implications of all of this. It feels as though, just from the perspective of Washington, D.C., why should I spend a lot of time thinking about Brussels? I'll make my own deals with France, Germany, and the U.K. It seems like the TTIP, Transatlantic Trade Treaty, is out. That's going to have to be renegotiated on a bilateral basis. And, you know, Turkey, forget that. That's not going to happen.
If you don't mind my saying so, John, I hope your diplomats have a slightly more sophisticated understanding of the issues than you've just displayed.
I hope they do too. But
firstly, in terms of trade, why does the EU matter to the United States? The EU is one of the largest economies in the world. We're the largest trading bloc by far.
I understand that, but why should I deal with Brussels and Paris? Why should I deal with
Brussels?
Because
you can't. Because when it comes to trade, you can't deal with Paris. The trade deals are decided by the European Union, negotiated by the European Union. When you want sanctions against Russia, They are decided by the European Union, not by individual member states. The sanctions against Iran were decided by the European Union. So the European Union is a hugely important ally for the United States, both economically, commercially, and in terms of foreign policy and security. So these are all the reasons.
That's a very persuasive point, but from the U.S. perspective, doesn't the U.K.'s withdrawal here make those critical issues hard to deliver from Brussels?
I don't see why, because we will still be 27, a slightly smaller market, but still the largest market in the world and the wealthiest market in the world. Of course, it's more complicated if the UK leaves. That's why the Americans didn't want the United Kingdom to leave. We're now going to have to deal with a new situation, which is suboptimal. But I don't agree with you that the trade negotiations are going to stop. Both sides are determined to move forward with this deal, to conclude it this year if we can. We will see what is the relationship of the United Kingdom to that deal.
But can I just ask you? I mean, how worried are you about that deal with the Brits out and Donald Trump railing against trade deals over across the Atlantic?
Well, again, I don't want to comment on your domestic politics. I observe that trade is a difficult issue in this election. I also observe that the animosity in the trade discussion is rather more about the Trans-Pacific partnership than a deal with Europe. With the UK out, we don't know. For the time being, the UK remains in. If the UK leaves, the UK could also sign on to this deal, even if it were outside the EU. So I think we are going to have to adapt to the new situation. But the fundamental purpose of the European Union, its role in the world, its role in trade and commerce, and its vital interest to the United States in the transatlantic context, in my view, will remain.
David O'Sullivan is the ambassador of the European Union to the United States. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Ambassador.
Thank you, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. And now it's time for The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quizmaster, who's won a Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions. Each time he's on, he'll play one of us in a game of trivia hosted by our producer, Sarah Ventry. This week, he's playing managing editor for the Arizona Science Desk, Kerry Fair-Snyder.
Last week, we gave you a puzzle to solve and randomly selected two entries. The puzzle was, throw away the outside and cook the inside, then eat the outside and throw away the inside. What is it? The answer, Steve, did you get this?
I did not. I thought it was something other than it was.
Okay, yeah.
Therefore, I got it wrong.
I only got it right because I saw the answer on a piece of paper. The answer is corn on the cob. Our randomly selected winners this week are Karen Goldberg and Karen Onsted. Leszek will play on behalf of Karen Goldberg. Kerry will play on behalf of Karen Onsted in our Karen versus Karen battle. Whoever wins will get a special KJZZ item.
Leszek, recently an eighth grader in Chicago gave a speech at his middle school graduation where he gave uncanny impressions of Trump, Clinton, Obama, and Sanders. While he was impersonating Bernie Sanders, he stated that the cinnamon rolls at the school were some of the best he's ever tasted, and then he called for what? Is it a universal cinnamon roll plan, a cinnamon roll revolution, or a dessert that the 99% could afford?
You know, I actually heard about the kid doing his impressions, but I don't remember what he said about the cinnamon. I'm going to say the first one.
Universal cinnamon roll plan?
That's the one.
Yeah. You are incorrect, Leszek. For a cinnamon roll revolution. All right, Kerry, you're starting up ahead.
Woohoo.
Which of the following is a tool that House Democrats used to stream video of themselves during the sit-in on gun control? Was it Skype, WhatsApp, or Periscope?
Periscope.
You are correct.
I knew that one. Damn it.
Of course you did, Leszek. All right, Leszek. You seem like a man of the world. Perhaps you can tell us about the British company called the Aroma Company that has developed a perfume modeled after what? Is it modeled after a comet, a cloud, or sand?
I have a vague recollection that it was modeled after a comet.
You are correct. What does a comet smell like, you might ask? Turns out that the scent is pungent. And it is sometimes compared to rotten eggs or bitter almonds.
I don't need a perfume for that.
All right, Kerry, it's 1-1. As humans age, we tend to become less social and are more likely to spend time with people that we're already close to, as opposed to maybe more casual acquaintances. According to a recent study in Current Biology, the same is true of what animal? Is it dolphins, monkeys, or turtles?
Monkeys.
It is monkeys.
Okay.
All right. So let's see, 2-1. Leszek, you definitely have to get this one right.
I do indeed.
Which of the following is a new style trend where the color on your hair mimics something you might see while driving? Is it the sunset trend where your hair starts an intense blonde at the roots and then cascades down into bright oranges, pinks, and purples? Is it the oil slick, which blends green, blue, and purples together to look like an oil slick that you'd see on the road? Or is it the smoggy day, which is a grayish, smoky coloring that mimics the combination of clouds, fog, and pollution?
I have no clue, so it's just going to be a random wild guess. Oil slick.
It is the oil slick.
Ah!
It's totally the oil slick. All right, Carrie, if you get this question right, you will win. If not, you will force it to a tiebreaker.
Ooh.
Okay. A lock of David Bowie's actual hair was used to color match the wig on David Bowie's wax statue at Madame Tussauds in London. That lock of hair recently sold at auction. For how much? Is it $4,550, $10,950, or $18,750?
This is a wild guess. I'm going to say $18,700.
That is correct.
Oh!
Carrie, you win. You beat Leszek.
Yeah, congratulations, Carrie.
Well, thank you very much. It was fun playing.
And congratulations to this week's winner, Karen Onstead. We'll keep bringing Leszek back, so stay tuned for the next listener puzzle and your chance to be one of our at-home players.
The booms and bursts of fireworks will be heard around the valley this weekend to celebrate the 4th of July. Maybe you're already plotting out how to get the best view. Well, there are some people who don't get to watch the show because they're lighting it. They call themselves pyros, and today we hear from Kendon Victor, a head pyro at Fireworks Productions of Arizona.
The first time I burned my eyebrows off was when I was 13, so I've always played with fire when I was a kid. And I always had my brother on hose patrol. My younger brother was forced to have the hose to make sure we didn't set anything else on fire. Then when you step out for the first time and you light that first professional firework, that sound, that boom that just shakes your whole body, just has an adrenaline rush at that moment. So when you do the first one as an adult, you're like, this rocks. I want to do this again. All fireworks are fired out of individual tubes. Well, those tubes are all in racks. And so in order for us to begin the prep and do the show, we have to set up 40, 50, 60 racks with all these different tubes in and with all the different firework sizes. And then what I'm putting on here is a 1x4 wooden strut. You want fireworks to go vertically, not horizontally. And you see, I'm just gonna lower this right into the bottom of the tube. What I have in my hand is a fusee, and this is just a flare on the end of a stick. So we pull the safety cap off, light the fuse at the very bottom. It begins to burn. Most of the shows in Arizona, hand-fired by people out there with a flare in their hand. Generally, you try to arrive a little bit earlier in the morning to beat the heat, because our founding fathers didn't think of, like, say, 4th of March or 4th of April, okay? You get suited up. Now you're standing there and you're ready to go. Show begins. Boom! The first fireworks goes off. Head pyro yells fire. And then you can feel that concussive wave. Just that boom! And your whole body shakes. The ground kind of shakes. You can feel everything. So you go through the entire show, you've spent 15, 20 minutes out there, and then it comes time for the grand finale. The boom factor picks up immensely, and the concussive wave moving through the night sky becomes boom, 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 boom. And you can just feel that. You can feel the ground kind of move. You can see the tubes out there bouncing. And you can suddenly, you realize that it's become as bright as day above you. It's been nighttime for the most part. There's been some light. But now all of a sudden it becomes so bright you could probably read if you wanted to. people who shoot fireworks get to enjoy sort of the same thing that rock stars and athletes get to enjoy, which is the cheers and adulation at the end of the night of 1,000, 10,000, how many people cheering for you. It's just nobody knows who we are. So we are the silent, invisible entertainers out there.
And if you're curious where Kendon will be on the 4th, it's underneath the fireworks during the City of Mesa's show.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.